Thank you, Glenn, and thanks to all of you. I have to commend everybody for hanging on here to the last session on Friday afternoon. I'd also like to acknowledge my co-authors, Randy Norton, who was here earlier, Abraham Galadima, Roberto Soto, who now is in Mexicali Valley, Mexico, Baja California, and David Silvertooth, all of whom have contributed significantly to this project over the course of the past 15, 20 years that we've been in operation with it. As we all know, in any kind of terrestrial ecosystem, the first three limiting factors would be sunlight, water, and then bioavailable nitrogen. We certainly take advantage of the abundance of sunlight in the desert southwest with any crop production system, but certainly water is the first most limiting factor, and then bioavailable nitrogen falls in very quickly right behind. Those then serve as our two primary throttles with regard to a management of a cotton production system. And the management of that nitrogen and water in concert, of course, is extremely important to maintain vigor, yield potential throughout the course of the season, also quality of the crop. It's also important for us to manage that nitrogen and water with regard to economic, agronomic, and also environmental efficiency simultaneously. In an effort to manage nitrogen, one of the tools that we most commonly use is what we call a yield goal approach. And in that yield goal approach, we try to make some assessments of these basic pools of nitrogen as it's made available and taken up and utilized by a crop. In relation to that, we have a tendency to focus on two points primarily agronomically, one of which, of course, would be fertilizer nitrogen inputs, and the second would be the uptake utilization of that nitrogen out of that soil plant system by the crop. But in fact, one of the things that I think is most important for us to consider, it's difficult to do so, would be this interaction that's taking place at all times between the inorganic and organic nitrogen pools, this mineralization and mobilization transformation complex. It's difficult to make an assessment of that, and quite often what we do in an effort to make an assessment is, number one, slightly ignore it. Secondly, is make an assumption there's some relationship to preseason residual nitrate nitrogen, which is a snapshot, brief snapshot in time, to some kind of supplying power from this organic, inorganic transformation interactions. In relation to that, we know, of course, we have this inorganic nitrogen pool, an organic nitrogen pool. We know there's this mineralization and mobilization transformations that occur at all times, but the difficult part for us to assess is to what extent, what are the sizes of these pools, the relative sizes of these pools, and what are the rates and forms of transformation that take place, particularly as it comes into relation to plant-available nitrogen during the course of the season. To complicate that, the reality of it is it's not just a simple organic and inorganic pool. Organically speaking, we know there's a resistant or recalcitrant nitrogen pool, there's an easily mineralizable nitrogen pool, and there's some kind of a quasi-moderately mineralizable nitrogen, probably half a dozen other intermediate forms in between. So this adds to the difficulty in making this assessment to how much of that nitrogen will be transformed and made available into this relatively small inorganic nitrogen pool, which of course is important, critically important, with regard to plant available nitrogen during the crop production season. This isn't a new problem. It's interesting to note in the literature, you go back even to 1955, Franklin Allison had a classic paper, The Enigma of Soil Nitrogen Balance Sheets, which he outlined the difficulty in quantifying nitrogen gains and losses in any crop plant system. A few years later, 11 years later, in fact, he had a follow-up article and of advances of agronomy, and they were recognizing at that time, our predecessors in this same business, that we were doing well if we had actually a 50% recovery of fertilizer nitrogen in a soil plant system and across many crops, many conventional agronomic and horticultural crops. We're still dealing with a very similar process, very similar situation today. We've gained on this quite a lot, but we still have this problem with regard to, so to speak, the enigma of a soil nitrogen balance sheet. We have made an effort to address this over the course of the past 10 years or so, 15 years. We've been working on some long-term nitrogen management projects in Arizona, three locations, central Arizona, Maricopa at about 1,000-foot elevation at Marana, which is about 2,000 feet elevation, and then in the southeast part of the state at Safford at about 3,000 feet elevation. These projects have been reported on at these meetings in the past, but they consisted of a consistent regimen of treatments, four treatments, a check, zero nitrogen applied, everything else managed in an optimal fashion. Second treatment was what we called a standard, and it was an aggressive standard, pretty much the grower standard. These were designed for practical applications. And they have treatments of up to 200 to 250 pounds per year on an average basis, beginning around 1990 when we started these projects. The third treatment was a feedback approach, and that was basically our practice, what we preach. It was a split application and basically utilizing this yield goal type approach. And then a fourth treatment, which was a 2X of treatment number three. Now, this did three things for us. It gave us a range of treatments, a range of nitrogen rates to evaluate. It gave us a range of comparison of different strategies, and also gave us a direct way of testing our recommendation refinement of our nitrogen management recommendations. And brief results and summary from those projects, we found the feedback treatment, that treatment number three, turned out to be our most consistent and most reliable with regard to efficient nitrogen utilization, yield, et cetera, and is most stable across all environments as well, all three environments. We have reported on that here and elsewhere. What we were doing in essence then is trying to utilize this, what we call nitrogen application window, that basically exists from Pinhead Square at about 700 heat units after planting to peak bloom, was about 2,000 heat units after planting, which we had found from other studies, related studies, that also related to our peak nitrogen uptake period, which is shown by these nitrogen uptake flux curves with two distinct peaks, one occurring at Pinhead Square, the first at Pinhead Square, the second at approximately peak bloom. So basically that's how we were operating with regard to that nitrogen management or nitrogen application window. From some companion experiments that we ran with these long-term nitrogen studies, we did some N15 recovery work, and what we found from those split applications, now these were basically application treatments that occurred on three different times through that window, all treatments being applied through that nitrogen application window, we had recoveries of over 80% total fertilizer nitrogen, with about 30% of that being taken up in the plant per se, the rest of that being recovered about 50, 55, 60% perhaps in the soil as labeled N15 residual nitrogen. Of course, then the question comes back into this residual nitrogen effect. When will this nitrogen become available? And what's the pattern and process with regard to the recovery of this residual nitrogen in subsequent years? We also found most of this nitrogen, soil nitrogen, was recovered in the top 12 inches, top 30 centimeters of the soil profile, which is consistent with a lot of other experiments of this type. The yield responses were interesting with regard to our variability, seasonal variability. But one of the things that was very important with regard to our review of this, these long-term nitrogen studies, were the responses associated with the checks, tremendous amount of variability associated with the check plots. Remember, none of these checks, all plots have been maintained with consistent integrity. There are four reps, eight rows wide, full length of the irrigation run at every one of these locations. Yet we had consistent variability, consistent, interesting variability from all locations, all environments, with regard to these check responses. In other words, residual nitrogen was feeding into this effect in a significant manner over time, and we finally decided it was time to evaluate this in 2000. In 2000, we took each of those locations, those three long-term nitrogen locations, and terminated all nitrogen treatments in 2000, after 2000. In 2001, we began these residual nitrogen treatments to begin to try to tease out some of these relationships to residual soil nitrogen over time. No fertilizer nitrogen was applied beyond that point to any of the treatments. We did yield and lint estimates, plant measurements, vigor, fruit retention on all of our treatments, all locations, all reps. And we harvested in, of course, the center four rows from those eight row plots. We also evaluated these nitrate nitrogen profiles each year down to 120 centimeters. I should add, too, is very importantly, from the comments at the onset of this discussion, that water was maintained in an optimal fashion. So we did measure water inputs and water depletion and irrigate in a timely fashion to make water non-limiting in each of these sites. What I want to focus on right now is just the Maricopa location. The Marana farm was sold by the university in 2004, so we lost those plots. It was effectively terminated at that time. And the experiments in 2004 were terminated at Safford because of limitations in space at that location. At Maricopa in central Arizona, at each location, we had measurements of the irrigation water inputs from nitrate nitrogen. At Maricopa, we're on an irrigation district from the Stanfield Maricopa Irrigation District, and we found that that's not just Colorado River water, which is relatively low in nitrate nitrogen, but it's being blended with well waters, which are significant, and it's one of the really learning factors or points to demonstrate from this project that that's an important assessment to make and not make an assumption that you have a, negligible or some given amount of, say, nitrate nitrogen contributions coming through the water. They vary tremendously, but on the average, there were about 7 part per million nitrate nitrogen. This contributed about 9.5 pounds of nitrate nitrogen per acre per irrigation, with a total of about, on the average, of about 65 to 70 pounds of nitrate nitrogen per acre per season, just through the irrigation water alone. Looking at that residual nitrogen in terms of these snapshot nitrate nitrogen assessments, it's interesting to note if you look at the top left-hand panel in 2000, they averaged typically in the top portion of the profile at about 8 to 10 part per million. In 2002, they varied a little bit more. They were, say, from 10 to 15, 20 part per million. But after 2002, everything in all sites, all locations, all treatments, all four of those residual treatment regimes dropped to less than 5 part per million, and they were consistent with that point on up through today. They're usually running about 3 to 4 part per million, really close to the detection limit with the analytical procedures we're using, which are cadmium reduction procedures from those soil extracts. If you try to work up one of these nitrogen budgets from this information, summarizing it all together, you find that from the irrigation water input we had on the average over the course since 2001 at Maricopa, approximately 70 pounds of nitrogen added to the system with the irrigation water per season. If you look at these residual nitrogen estimates based on that little snapshot of time from the soil nitrate nitrogen preseason test, there's maybe about 15 pounds of nitrate nitrogen in the top 1 foot of the soil profile that's available that we sampled on a consistent basis. So that would give us on a nitrogen budget about 85 pounds of N that we can account for that's going into the system. You look at the yield data, the vertical line drawn at 2001 shows the demarcation for the beginning of the residual treatments, residual projects begin. All nitrogen treatments are terminated at that point. So I'd like to kind of focus your attention to that portion of the slide, and you'll see what basically we see, as you would expect, a decline in lint yields over time, a dramatic drop in 2004, which we don't get a lot of rainfall in Arizona, but in the deserts, but when they come in these torrential monsoon storms quite often that can be devastating, as you can see from the yield responses in 2004. Looking at this probably more appropriately with the relative yield data, again, I draw your attention to the data primarily beyond that vertical line where the residual studies began. And you see basically what you see happening later on in the project is an increase, a subtle increase, not statistically significant, but a subtle increase in the yield in relation to nitrogen uptake from the higher residual treatments in comparison to the checks. The checks were pretty stable all the way across the board, which is interesting to note, even for the past 15 years, with zero fertilization in those check plots. Another way of looking at this, too, if you then back calculate out the nitrogen uptake that had to take place from the total input into the crop, which we were finding was about still consistent with our previous information in other places as well, at about 60 to 65 pounds of nitrogen per bale on the average is what these were recovering. You see a general decline or decrease in nitrogen uptake over time. Again, if you actually take and extract out the 2004 data from that, call that an anomaly, you get a little better linear relationship, which shows us that we're getting a decline of about 10 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year. We would assume that's a reduction in residual nitrogen. And we've gone from a range of about 200 down to about 120 pounds of total yield potential with those plots, all treatments responding very similarly and not really showing any significant response due to any high residual rate from the higher nitrogen treatments over time, except for that one relative yield slide that showed some slight variation over time with the higher treatments, higher nitrogen treatments showing little higher yield potential. In summary, what we're finding from this, we've had a total nitrogen uptake that we've been able to record from 200 to 120 pounds as yields have declined over time. Mineralization estimates from this, as you back those out, would indicate we're getting nitrogen mineralization from these plots on the average of about 115 to 35 pounds of nitrogen through the mineralization. Difficult to make that assessment pre-season from the tests that we've had thus far. And they're decreasing at a rate of about 10 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year. Now, at this one location in Maricopa, central Arizona, less than 1% soil organic matter, we wouldn't expect to see much of a nitrogen contribution from residual nitrogen at any time with low organic matter soils of this type. But what we've been able to show is that these have been significant throughout the duration of these long-term nitrogen treatments, and through these residual treatments as well. We've been able to sort this out with regard to overall nitrogen inputs through water, through residual say, that residual nitrogen preseason, and then what is being contributed through mineralization proves to be significant. The danger, the problem that we have is how do we make an accurate assessment of that preseason with regard to coming back to nitrogen recommendations and these nitrogen balance studies as sheets that we'd like to put together preseason for accurate, optimal efficiency for recommendations. Right now, what we're finding after 6 years of duration, and we've had to terminate the Maricopa experiment as well because of limitations with land space there. In 2007, we found that we finally, after 6 years of residual study, we're almost bringing those plots into what we might call a balance with regard to irrigation water inputs that we can actually track and keep an assessment of. So it comes back to the beginning. Are we any better off than Franklin Allison was in 1955? I think we're a little better off, but we do recognize the need for an assessment of this residual nitrogen, even under these low organic matter soils that we would assume very easily to be negligible or very low with regard to nitrogen mineralization capacities. And I think they add to us quite a bit with regard to the year-to-year seasonal variability we have in making assessments on our nitrogen recommendations. And I think that's particularly important in the time of increasing need for efficiency with our crop nitrogen inputs, but from three ways: agronomically, economically, and in terms of environmental efficiency here as well. I appreciate your attention this morning. I think we have a little time for some questions or comments. If you would have any, I'd be happy to entertain those now, and I can do so. Yes, sir, Wayne.
Do you see any segregation of nitrogen or any separating of nitrates that moves through the field on those irrigation runs? Does it build up at the head, decrease at the tail, or is it fairly uniform through the field?
Everybody hear Glenn's question, or Wayne's question? He's asking if I have any distribution of nitrate from the head of the tail, head of the run to the end of the run because of these water distributions. A direct answer to that, we actually haven't looked for variability in nitrate, nitrogen per se in the soil from the head of the field to the bottom. But what we have done, Wayne, we've had incidental with these studies in these same fields, we've done water measurements. So I would assume the nitrate's moving where the water's moving. And what we're finding is, generally speaking, these are not quite dead level basins that we're working in. But where we have good control of the water, we're having pretty good control of uniformity and distribution of that nitrate. So I'm not seeing a variability in regard to yield, crop growth, et cetera, from head to tail, other than the natural heterogeneity out in these plots. One of the reasons, too, which we implemented in this from 1990 when we started these studies, these plots were all full length of the irrigation run. That's 600 feet on the average basis. 600 feet, 8 rows wide, 40-inch rows wide with 4 replications to try to account for that variability. But that hasn't been significant. And the biggest concern we have, again, comes back to water distribution. And we can tell that pretty readily. But we're close to dead level basins, less than 1% slope, less than a half of 1% slope in each case, which is what helps. That's what helps. Good question, though. Anything else? Anybody else? Yes, sir. Kevin. Yeah, we've actually sampled the question of leaching through the root zone. We've usually sampled to 120 centimeters depths through the profiles when we've come back to pick up the residual end of season nitrogen. And most of that nitrate nitrogen is in the top, nitrate nitrogen as well as any form of total nitrogen is in the top 30 centimeters of the soil. So we're probably losing some through leaching, some, but it doesn't seem to be significant. It's leaving a lot of residual nitrogen just scattered low in the profile. And when we've done tracing studies, for example, with bromide, say a biologically conserved tracer like bromide, you can see those pulses moving through the profile with the water, particularly when we get to the point where we get to saturation through Darcyan flow, and after you get full saturation, then you're actually moving through the profile. So we know we're getting some movement through there, but we don't find a residual pulse left at the bottom of the profile or anywhere in that profile during the course of the season when we've sampled. Good point, though. We're losing some, but it's probably relatively small. Yes, sir.
Last quick question.
Just as a matter of comment, I was quite impressed with really how well you've been able to balance that up. But it seems to me that one of the things that in a number of our studies, we're going to have the ability to see a better understanding of what the microbial communities are with the tools we now have. It strikes me that we may have, in fact, be seeing microbial cycling.
Right.
Particularly with
Well, thank you, and I would have to agree with you. I'm in totally concert with your ideas about the, you know, the core of this is in the microbiological ecology, the microbial community, which we know very little about, quite honestly, with regard to the numbers of species. What are these species of microbes? How are they interacting? And it's very, very important for us, too, as you indicate, as we change cropping systems. We probably know that we're changing the suite of species in that microbial ecosystem as we change through cropping systems, not just through a crop rotation, but also maybe tillage systems, organic production systems. And I think that's right where the crux of this lies, is making getting a better handle on what's happening with regard to the microbial communities. We're mediating those heterotrophic organisms that are helping mediate these transformations, and that's right at the heart of it. So one of the other jobs that I get to have is I'm head of a department of soil, water, and environmental science, and what I see the microbial community doing in terms of the scientists. The scientists doing today and the breakthroughs and where we're moving with regard to these technologies and tools is exciting in that respect. So I'm hopeful that we can maybe begin to break some of these barriers that Franklin Allison recognized over 50 years ago. Very good point. Thank you.
Let's give Jeff a hand. Thanks.
Thanks, Lynn. You bet.